So it's a real pleasure to welcome back Salim Hotinli. Salim's a very frequent visitor to our group at Perimeter. He's collaborated with many of us here. He's currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Johns Hopkins University, and he works on topics related to the cosmic microwave background. And today in his seminar, he'll be telling us all about new discoveries in the era of low noise, high resolution cosmological experiments. Please go ahead, Salim.
All right, thank you, and sorry for that start. all right, so yeah, thanks for the invitation to talk to you about some of my work. And I will be discussing in this talk mainly about the potential directions for new discoveries in the upcoming low-noise, high-resolution cosmology experiments. So these include CMB experiments such as Simons Observatory, CMBS4, Lightbird, South Pole Observatory, as well as large-scale structure experiments such as Rubin, LSST, DESI, Euclid, and SphereX, and Roma Space Telescope. So there's a lot of them. And they will transform our understanding of cosmology and cosmological astrophysics in the near future, in particular through the joint analysis of CMB and different tracers of large-scale structure data, which is the focus of my talk. So these scientific programs are increasingly gaining attention as they often increase the prospects to detect and characterize new signals by reducing systematics, canceling cosmic variance, breaking degeneracies, and so on. And I'll be discussing using CMB as a backlight, observing the scattering and the gravitational lensing effects on the CMB by the intervening cosmological structure at different epochs in the universe. So on these lines, I will be focusing in part on the kinetic Sinyonza-Aldrich effect experienced by the CMB photons, which depends on the bulk peculiar velocities and the density of electrons. As I will mention briefly soon, it leads to the CMB being statistically anisotropic due to variations of the velocity field over the cosmological volume. And through utilizing this anisotropy, we can reconstruct the large-scale velocity fields, for example, using a technique called KSC tomography. And various work by colleagues, as well as mine, has demonstrated that this program will provide some of the most precise tests of fundamental physics. Official mention, one recent work in what follows. In addition to fundamental physics, this program has also the potential to open, new and unique windows into cosmological astrophysics, into unexplored epochs of structure formation, such as the epoch of helium ionization, which I'll describe in what follows, and I'm pretty excited about that. And later in the talk, I'll discuss other CMB secondaries, such as the polarized Sinyonza-Aldrich effect, the moving lens effect, and lensing, and so on, focusing essentially on describing efforts towards their first detection and the prospects of doing cosmological inference, through measurement and characterization of these signatures. Unfortunately, I think I won't be able to go into much detail about mitigating lensing and scattering effects in the CMB, but feel free to ask me about those as well if you like. To know more. And I'll of course mostly base this talk on my published work and papers, but I will refer to some ongoing and future work as well in multiple points. And one thing to note is that these programs, they will not require new experiments than those that are being built or proposed. So they're mainly about using the data we have intelligently. Okay, great. So let me first give a very brief primer on the kinetic Sinyonza-Aldrich effect before demonstrating the role of this effect in probing fundamental physics with one example. The KSC effect is a Doppler effect due to CMB photons scattering off energetic electrons in the large-scale structure, and the large-scale structure that has some non-zero radial velocity, and it's expected to be detected to very high signal-to-noise in the upcoming years. And the prospects of detecting KSC to such high signal-to-noise results in an ever-increasing interest in this effect, with initial papers now being increasingly cited more than thousands of times, and the initial detection paper being cited over hundreds of times, which is no surprise, really, because it is evident from looking at the CMB and the actual signal that the KSC will dominate the black body contribution to the CMB on small scales. You know, it will constitute essentially to all of the black body signal we observe on small scales in the future. Okay. Now, the KSC effect depends on the radial velocity of electrons. You know, so in a volume of the universe where the radial velocities are large, the KSC effect is also large. And in a volume where the velocities are small or vanishing, the effect also vanishes. So if one acquires a tracer of the small-scale electron distribution, this would lead to a statistical variation of the cross power between the tracer and the CMB over cosmological distances, depending on the underlying velocity distribution. So I could look at one part of the sky and take the average CMB large-scale structure cross power, for example, in that patch, and it would be some number depending on the bulk velocity. And we look at another part of the sky, and the power would be some other number due to a different mean bulk velocity in that patch. Now, as a result, I can write estimators that capitalize on the statistical anisotropy and reconstruct the underlying cosmological velocity field as sketched in this figure with the Fourier amounts combined to give a squeezed bispectrum, which is the underlying statistics of this procedure. And once reconstructed, the velocities can be combined with measurements of density fluctuations on large scales for cosmological inference. And this has huge benefits. So first of all, the noise of the reconstructed velocities, they behave like velocity, you know, meaning that it scales with an extra factor of k to the minus one. And one wishes to constrain density fluctuations with them, for example. This means that the noise on the density becomes much smaller on large scales, you know, compared to density shot noise, for example. This is shown in this figure by the PI group a while ago, which makes it clear that, like, you know, how the KSC noise actually behaves on larger scales, making it a very powerful probe for inference on these scales. And the second benefit is that one acquires an additional measure of the matter power spectrum, can in principle compare to matter power spectra, as demonstrated with this set of equations here. So these terms here are the ratio space terms due to our, you know, measurements being in ratio space. These other terms are the relationship between the velocity and the density fluctuations on large scales, where the fluctuations are linear. And these terms are reconstruction biases from velocity tomography due to potential mismodeling of the cross power between traces of electrons, such as galaxies, and the actual electron distribution itself. And these final terms, of course, are the matter power spectra, which combination of these equations allow candling so that the coefficients I highlight here, the galaxy bias and the cosmological growth rate, can be measured without being limited by the cosmic variance. So this leads to a drastic inference on, you know, prospects of probing fundamental physics from galaxy bias or the growth rate, which are very sensitive to changes to initial conditions or the contents of the universe. One such example, for example, is the local type of primordiality, which leads to a galaxy bias gaining scale dependence in its presence. And the improvement due to KSC is around an order of magnitude, you know, compared to using galaxy surveys alone. For example, due to the benefits I just mentioned. So this analysis will essentially push the constraints on the amplitude of the local type 9 cohomogeneity, this FNL, below 1 in the near future, which is an important threshold, you know, distinguishing multi-field inflationary models from the simplest single-field inflationary models. So, okay, so that was pretty fast, but I didn't want to lose too much time on recapping the KSC tomography. But here I would, but you can ask me questions if anything is unclear. So I would like to briefly describe an extension to that previous work by considering the scale-dependent correction to the galaxy bias in more fuller terms, which includes the FNL term, parametrizing the amplitude of the squeezed bispectrum non-Gaussianity, as well as this tau and L term, the amplitude of the squeezed trispectrum. So in the limit of single field slow roll inflation, these parameters are related. You know, the squeezed trispectrum being parametrized essentially by squares of the bispectrum. But in the case of multi-field inflation, where new degrees of freedom other than inflaton field may become relevant to the early universe dynamics, This tau and L may deviate from the prediction in the case of single field slow roll inflation. And this deviation is a model dependent deviation, you know, by an amount related to the relative power, for example, of the different primordial fields. And this tau and L is actually a very difficult signature to measure. And the constraints from directly measuring tau and L on large scale CMB, for example, with Planck, are, you know, at the order of thousands. But it is similarly predictive, like FNL. And in a recent work led by a student that I'm advising since, we've shown that the KSC will be a great tool for measuring this parameter as well, also to a very high precision, you know, over an order of magnitude better than galaxy surveys in isolation. And you can see here that the galaxy surveys are limited by the cosmic variance to the matter power spectra. And that's why you see these pink lines flattening with increased galaxy density in the left plot. Combining KSC with galaxies, moreover, you can see that the constraints improve without being limited in this way. And I find this to be particularly exciting, you know, in my opinion, as it will give an opportunity to unambiguously probe, you know, unknown components in the early universe by comparing different forms of higher order statistics of density fluctuations. And I would further argue that, you know, these efforts are somewhat complementary to the core science programs of the CMB experiments, you know, such as measuring the effective number of relative degrees of freedom and effective, for example. So that is to say that the KSC tomography, you know, will indeed play an important role about learning, you know, about degrees of freedom in the early universe, potentially allowing a large range of inflationary parameter space, probing a large range of inflationary space, either through probing primordial non-Gaussianity, as I just discussed, or also through, for example, primordial Isaac curvature, for example, which you can find discussed in some of my papers. In addition to the scale-dependent bias, you know, KSC tomography also probes the cosmological growth, as can be seen with this relation between the density fluctuations and velocity, for example. And I would be very interested to update you on various ongoing projects that I'm working on this as well, if you're interested, but I will omit doing so for now for time constraints. But I'll briefly mention, before moving into astrophysics, another interesting direction, I think, for using KSC tomography, which is through utilizing the 21 centimeter hydrogen line measurements as tracers of large scale structure. So KSC is sourced, you know, during reionization, and the signal is anticipated to be comparable to the late time KSC, as you can see in this plot. So this pink line is the late time KSC here, and then this orange dashed line is the reionization KSC. And in the past few years, we have shown that in principle, one can do velocity tomography during this epoch as well. As shown in this here, where the blue solid curve is the underlying velocity signal. These gray lines correspond to the reconstruction noise values that one can achieve with a dedicated experiment, indicating at least some large-scale modes can in principle as well. And one interesting quality of the velocity fields, you know, during this time is that they're much more related to primary CMB than compared to velocities. So I'm just being told that my connection is unstable. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you, although the audio quality maybe hasn't been the greatest in the past couple of minutes. But I mean, but it's fine. Okay.
All right, let me try to soldier on a little. I was saying one quality of these velocity fields at these high redshifts is that they're much more correlated with the primary CMB than compared to velocities at lower redshifts. And this correlation is actually non-trivial, meaning, you know, different scales are differently correlated with different contributions to the CMB, such as the Doppler, the Sachs-Wolff, or the integrated Sachs-Wolff terms. This suggests that, you know, KSC tomography can potentially be used as a probe for CMB anomalies as well, for example, such as the hemispherical power asymmetry or various features, you know, such as observed low power on the CMB fluctuations in largest scales. So that's pretty exciting. And in the same work, we also demonstrated that the joint analysis of CMB and 21 centimeter using the KSC effect could potentially improve measurements of various physical parameters that describe the reionization process as well. So you can check our paper for more on that. But in short, KSC tomography, I think, is a wonderfully fruitful area that will, you know, potentially contribute significantly to our understanding of fundamental characteristics of our universe, you know, in multiple different ways. And the game is now to convince everyone that it actually really works, as we have done in some PI folk in this paper I link here, where we tested the KSC reconstruction with simulations and provided a public code to reconstruct the velocities from CMB maps and maps of large-scale structure, as well as coding up the theory predictions of various related signals. So my near future work on these lines really focuses on extending these efforts, you know, improving these pipelines and making them ready for data from the Simons Observatory, for example. And I would like to discuss, you know, in more detail what those efforts involve, if you're interested in chatting with me during the week. I also believe that there's still ways to show or further emphasize the scientific benefit of this program in creative ways. In particular, you know, KSC measurements, they stand to play a crucial role, not only for the inference of fundamental properties of the universe, but also for astrophysics. One immediate application, of course, is the measurement of the KSC temperature profiles around halos, for example, to test whether the distribution of baryons, you know, follow dark matter NFW profiles or not, as demonstrated in this Sean et al. Paper, which shows that indeed the baryons do deviate. And I'm not going to go into much details about this plot, but what it demonstrates is that baryons or the electron gas is more extended compared to dark matter, is what this plot shows. And there has been work in literature, you know, in different work that shows the KSC temperature profiles, you know, measuring the KSC temperature profiles and then comparing them with model predictions, you know, or evaluating KSC and TSC measurements and how combining them could improve, you know, constraints on electron gas models, for example. I, in fact, have also a student working with me on these directions, you know, extending these previous works, including other CMB secondaries to the mix as well. But what I've been most excited in particular in the recent months is thinking about how we can use the KSC measurements to explore essentially a previously underexplored epoch of early structure formation, that is the epoch of helium reionization. And I written two recent papers where I began demonstrating that the prospects of detecting and characterizing this major cosmological transition with the KSC tomography. So in what follows, I will try and motivate this direction of research a little bit, which I believe can turn into a significant field on its own, you know, in the next years. Okay, any questions so far? All right. So the reionization of hydrogen, which is expected to have occurred around redshift 6 to 10, is quite evident, and many, you know, dedicated experiments are searching for the 21 centimeter hydrogen line signal. During this time, the ionization fraction, which I show here, goes from 0 to 1, where 1 refers to, in this case, a free electron per hydrogen atom. And the signals from this epoch, of course, are very interesting for astrophysics, as their properties will teach us about formation of first stars, as well as the effects of various mechanisms, such as the baryonic feedback, to the process of star formation. But hydrogen reionization is not only the cosmological transition. There's also helium. You know, both electrons and helium also ionizes over the cosmic history. Now, while the reionization of the first electron in the helium requires an energy that is similar to ionization of hydrogen, so it occurs actually around the same epoch of hydrogen reionization as evident in this plot. You know, the ionization fraction actually exceeds 1 here and then goes to 1.08, depending on the ratio of the helium to hydrogen. Fully ionizing helium requires around 54 eV. And since photons emitted by the first stars sourcing the reionization of hydrogen are not energetic enough to fully ionize helium, the high helium reionization, which I'll refer as the ionization of the second electron in the helium, occurs only after the emergence of substantial number of quasars or AGN activity at around redshift 3, where you can see the ionization fraction increasing by another 8%. All right, so as a result, the history of helium reionization really strongly depends on properties of quasars. you know, such as their luminosity function, accretion mechanisms, and other astrophysics, their clustering, variability, lifetimes, as well as the general growth and evolution of supermassive black holes. And it should also be related to what is now understood to be a complex cycle of baryons, you know, within the IGM and the circumgalactic medium that regulate the star formation and the black hole accretion. So I think it's a potentially, fantastically interesting probe for astrophysics that needs to be looked into. So in a recent work, we explored how KST tomography can actually probe this epoch of helium reionization through measuring the free electron fraction. Here I show a figure from our paper where I show with error bars the measurement accuracy on the amplitude of the velocity fluctuations reconstructed with KST tomography at various redshift bins from joint analysis of galaxy surveys, in this case, Rubin LSST and MegaMapper. MegaMapper is a proposed extension to DESI, which will do spectroscopic measurements of galaxies detected by Rubin, and two CMB experiments, essentially CMBS4 and CMBHD. These errors on the velocities amount to a proxy for the measurement precision of the ionization fraction, which I'll describe shortly. But I want to also note that here I show three reionization models, helium reionization models, labeled with numbers 1 to 3, that are chosen to roughly match the models considered in simulations and represent several plausible scenarios of helium reionization. For example, model 1 reproduces the typical measured quasar abundance and spectrum, and the quasar clustering measured by BOSS, for example. And model 2 uses quasar abundances reduced by a factor of 2, which are consistent with the measured uncertainties, but yields a slightly later reionization scenario. This model 3 uses a uniform UV background rather than explicit quasar sources, and it does reproduce some of the similar numerical models in the literature. So distinguishing between these models can provide an independent determination, you know, of the average abundance and luminosities of quasars, which complements direct measurements from surveys like STSS, for example. So I think it's pretty interesting. I should also note that the precise details of helium reionization, you know, such as its duration, its timing, morphology, they're largely unknown. And surveys of helium and hydrogen Lyman alpha forests can, you know, they can probe some evidence for the details of this epoch, but these measurements are very difficult in practice, and they're subject to severe astrophysical and systematic uncertainties about the inferred flux levels of the Lyman alpha forest. You know, surveys of Lyman alpha, helium Lyman alpha, for example, are subject to intervening Lyman alpha limit, Lyman limit systems at lower redshifts from other signals, which significantly, you know, reduces the prospects of characterizing the epoch of helium reionization unambiguously, you know, from these observables. Similarly, hydrogen Lyman alpha, you know, provides only an indirect evidence of helium reionization through probing thermal history of the IGM, whose measurement is really subject to significant systematic and modeling uncertainties. So all of that really suggests that additional probes of helium reionization we consider here, you know, will be valuable for increasing the prospects to unambiguously characterizing this epoch. Okay, so how does that work? So the idea is very simple. The KST effect depends on the ionization fraction, you know, through its dependence on the free electron distribution. You know, if when reconstructing the velocity field, the ionization fraction is not taken into account accurately, the reconstructed velocity field will become biased by some amount that depends on the ratio between the true ionization fraction and the fiducial, you know, choice in the model. One can simply turn this fact around and to make the point that, you know, reconstructed velocities are actually tracers of this ionization fraction in this way. So that's the idea. And just for clarity, this term here is a true radial velocity. And this term parameterizes the KST bias due to mismodeling of the small scale electron cross power with the UCT tracers. Now, of course, these two terms are degenerate, as you can see, for a given redshift bin. But this degeneracy gets broken, you know, ones that one involves multiple reshapins, as the bias due to mismodeling heme reionization has a specific reshap dependence, for example. Okay. Any questions? Hey,
just to make sure that I'm understanding. So you mentioned that there is this degeneracy between the velocity bias and the mean electron fraction.
I
could imagine that this velocity bias itself could have strong evolution across these redshifts because it'll depend upon like which galaxy sample that you're cross correlating with, right?
Right.
So,
Right. So far we have assumed essentially no bias on it, and just marginalized over individual amplitudes and taken in essentially like the statistical power coming from the specific variation of the velocity field with mismatching the true ionization fraction. So it's true. Like if it varies drastically over that path, you know, it might be a problem to detect it. Although we do have a very specific, you know, feature in the bias from the helium ionization. So I don't know if it will be totally degenerate, but it might. It might be problematic. I don't know. We haven't checked it too. We haven't modeled the velocity bias from an electron model. Maybe we should do that to make sure we get a good estimate of what the actual signal to noise is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I see. Thanks.
Yeah, but we do marginalize over it without assuming anything. So.
We do marginalize over
individual, like, you know, errors. So basically no information comes from a single bin. The information only comes from comparing different bins to each other, but that might be degenerate with the actual velocity bias that I'm not sure of, actually. Yeah.
So you do or you do not marginalize over some arbitrary history for this B of Z?
We definitely do. We do marginalize over arbitrary history, and the resulting like numbers are from having marginalized over it.
And it's not degenerate.
So it's not totally degenerate. These are the boxes that we're taking into account. And the final constraints on the reionization parameters involve marginalizing over the amplitudes of individual like velocity reconstruction. We do marginalize over the biases. So all the information comes from comparing, for example, this bin to that bin and seeing that there is this much difference and so on due to the ionization fraction changing this much. So you can see like the error bars, for example, for a mega mapper in orange here, you know, they're small enough that this change can be detected. But if the underlining, the bias essentially results in a change that is comparable to this 8% over this redshift range, then I'm saying that maybe that needs to be taken into account more carefully if that's the case. Like if there is a similar degenerate change in the actual bias, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that might be a little problematic.
You are marginalizing over that?
We are marginalizing, but we're not assuming a fiducial model. So we're just simply marginalizing over the amplitudes. So the individual amplitude information does not contribute to the signal to noise or the measurement accuracy of the reionization parameters. Only the difference, like as long as we combine multiple redshift bins, like the information comes from comparing different redshift bins to one another.
Okay. Thanks.
That doesn't make sense.
Was there some simple way to understand what's breaking the degeneracy between this BV and the time evolution of XE?
I think like the errors are sufficiently small enough that this overall change can be detected. I guess that it would be something I haven't said so far that might help explaining. Like the errors, even though I'm having marginalized, the errors on the amplitudes are small enough so that this overall 8% change from KC tomography can be detected from multiple redshift pins.
Hmm. So I thought that like the amplitude of this signal was just proportional to, you know, to like the mean, like the mean number of electrons around each galaxy, you know, something like that. But you're saying that instead of that, it's separately proportional to the mean profile around these galaxies, and also the mean number of electrons in the universe.
Well, yeah, so this only assumes the homogeneous overall mean ionization fraction. I will talk about the patchy ionization in a little bit. But so far, we've just assumed that the mean ionization fraction on top of the electron density changes over a certain redshift range. And we're evaluating the prospects of detecting that change. Mm-hmm. So essentially, like the underlining, you know, ionization fraction moves in this kind of way. And, you know, if you've modeled your velocity, ionization fraction in the correct way, you would get an unbiased correct estimate for the velocity from these bins. But if you fail to take into account this change in the ionization fraction, that would bias your velocities, and that amounts to actually a way to detect, you know, different model. That makes the velocities sensitive to the underlining ionization fraction.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. This helps, I think. Thanks. I might ask you more about it later on.
Okay. Yeah. Let's discuss more. I think it was more clear in my head, but maybe I can describe in more words or make a better description. Right. But yeah, I guess this statement is that the 8% change is an overall large enough change that the errors at each velocity, each redshift bin is sufficient enough so that you can detect an overall change in the ionization fraction that is of this order compared to the errors. Okay, let me just describe a little bit more.
Can I use a different question. Can you use the auto power spectrum of galaxies to get the bias?
I think that's a really cool, irrespective of, the galaxy, you know, the optical light depends on, certainly, on the ionization of helium as well. The overall UV, I mean, it does depend on it. That's true. So that's something I'm generally interested in, trying to figure out how the actual optical light and the selection functions depend on the helium reionization as well. So they should depend on.
No, all I'm just saying that I mean the auto power spectrum in redshift space, but maybe you don't have redshifts for these galaxies. I'm actually don't know. Are these redshift surveys or not?
The LSST one is a photometric survey. So it has the mega mapper is a redshift survey.
Okay. Right.
The B that he's talking about isn't like the normal, you know, clustering bias, So his B is this like velocity bias, I think, right?
So it comes from the CMB. It comes from the fact that the CMB is sensitive to the ionization fraction through KSC effect. It doesn't come from galaxies. So in this analysis, the galaxies are insensitive to helium reionization. Galaxy bias does not depend on the helium reionization, but I was agreeing with you in the sense that I think it should in an interesting way, and one can.
So maybe I can follow after you're done. But yeah, okay, I should let you go on.
Okay, well, if we believe our work, returning back to the results of our paper, it appears that the Rubin LSST and CMBS4 will have the statistical power to characterize helium reionization by essentially measuring, you know, various parameters such as redshift half-life true reionization, as shown in this column, or the distance in redshift between which the reionization, the ionization fraction varies over 25% to 75%. So that's like mean distance in redshift that characterizes how wide this transition is. So it appears that for Rubin LSST and CMBS4, the errors on these parameters will be around the order of a redshift. But when we assume priors on the primordial helium abundance, you know, from external measurements, these constraints improve by a factor of two or so. So we found that to be pretty promising, I think, that you know, in the near future, that one can actually characterize helium reionization by this joint analysis. And we also find that future surveys like MegaMapper and CMBHD might provide, you know, much more increased precision on these parameters, allowing potentially like comfortably distinguishing between similar helium reionization models. Let me further motivate this a little bit. It's not only like, you know, one can not only perhaps learn about astrophysics, but since essentially all of the helium in the universe is ultimately doubly ionized, the total change in the ionization fraction would be a measure of the primordial helium abundance, which would be a sensitive probe of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, for example. Or moreover, you know, probing the helium reionization can also improve our understanding of relativistic species through improving the primordial helium fraction measurement and breaking the degeneracy between number of relativistic species, you know, ineffective and YP, which are degenerate in the CMB, for example. The primordial helium abundance is, you know, is also dependent on the weak interaction rates, as well as the neutron lifetime. So essentially, you know, improving its measurement can allow further valuable insight into our cosmological history and fundamental physics as well. And so we find the signal to noise for the detection of helium reionization, which I define as detection precision on this 8% change in the ionization fraction after marginalizing over the galaxy biases and the velocity biases and sigma 8 and growth factor, as well as the other reionization parameters, so everything else, to be around a few sigma for first year LSST data, you know, combined with Simons Observatory, so around 5 sigma, and around 10 sigma for the 10th year LSST data combined with CMBS4, and around 60 sigma for a mega mapper and combined with HT. So more recently, I also followed this work up with the question of whether we can detect helium reionization this way in the next few years, you know, for example, with Desi quasars. If we were to combine, you know, other large-scale structured tracers, such as cosmic infrared background, for example, which will be measured to high precision with CCAP prime in the next years. So I'll return back to this plot in a second, but first let me just say a few words about the CIB signal, which is sourced by the thermal radiation of dust grains in distant star-forming galaxies. You know, this thing, these dust grains absorb ultraviolet starlight, they heat up and they emit light in the infrared. And as the star formation rate of our universe peaks around redshifts 2 to 3, the CIB ends up being sourced dominantly from galaxies at around these redshifts, which coincide with the epoch of helium reionization. So this plot here shows, you know, the redshift kernel for the CIB signal at various frequencies. And you can see that it kind of coincides with the helium reionization redshifts 2 to 4. This black curve here is the lensing redshift kernel, just for comparison. So the currently available CIB maps provided by Planck already allow CIB power spectrum to be measured, I think, up to around sub-degree scales, you know, sufficient for a cosmological and astrophysical inference. But the experiments such as CCAP prime will allow, you know, really high resolution measurements of the CIB down to arc minute scales. So this here, I showed these purple lines, the anticipated measurement noise of the CCAP prime like survey at various frequencies. And these blue solid lines correspond to the anticipated CIB signals. Now, such CIB maps can in principle also be used as tracers of electrons on small scales, and can be utilized, you know, to reconstruct the velocity fields via KSC tomography upon cross-correlation with the CMB, just as in the case of galaxy tracers. But this might be somewhat less intuitive, you know, compared to galaxies which come with redshift information. In this case, we have this integrated two-dimensional map. So how can one do tomography? But we indeed find using simulations that KSC tomography can also be performed with high accuracy CIB maps, you know, such as the upcoming ones. In fact, this is evident from testing with actual simulations of CMB and CIB, like we did here, where these plots use the WebSky simulations for CMB and CIB, and I demonstrate the reconstructed velocities at the given redshift bin. And you can see that the velocity and the reconstructed velocity and the true velocities actually do match well on large scales. I believe that the ability to reconstruct velocities is crucially related to the full sky treatment we apply here, you know, suggestive also from the fact that the SNR is extremely peaked towards larger scales, meaning only, you know, a few larger scale modes can be expected to be reconstructed. And I have some extra slides on this to further demonstrate this point if needed. But for now, I want to continue the talk, arguing that the CIB for KSC tomography is indeed possible. But any questions? All right. So my analysis using CIB, as you can see here with these orange error bars compared to the KSC using galaxies with these blue error bars. In fact, the CIB seems to be more powerful at redshifts where it actually gets peaked. Suggests that, you know, the prospects of detecting helium ionization, this time using maps on the light cone and adding CIB tomography into the picture, is somewhat similar. And it is still somewhat pessimistic for the combination of DESI and SO, where I find the SNR will not reach beyond 2, even after including weak lensing to the analysis. But for CMBS4 and Rubin LSST, I find similar results well within a factor of 2 of my previous findings, further motivating that, you know, this research direction might eventually prove fruitful and rewarding, that we can detect the helium ionization unambiguously using these methods. Okay, any questions so far? All right. Note that these efforts so far considered probing helium ionization via the change in the homogeneous ionization fraction. But in practice, you know, ionization of helium is expected to be patchy, just like in the case of reionization of hydrogen, as demonstrated in this video I took from a magazine. And I believe it's compiled and generated by Alvarez et al. At this point, I should restate, by the way, that, you know, one big difference in the compared to the hydrogen reionization is that the reionization of helium will likely occur as bubbles originating around quasars and not stars. I'll refer back to that in a second. Let me very briefly go through some work using joint analysis of CMB and large scale structure that aims to capture this patchiness of helium reionization and intends to understand the morphology of this transition, you know, not just this average quantities. So I actually now have a small task force of students that are also looking into these directions with me. All right, so the patchiness amounts to an anisotropic ionization fraction, or equivalently to a patchy tau. And one method to reconstruct this patchy tau is from measurements of CMB temperature and polarization, which are essentially subject to scattering and screening effects, you know, in a way dependent on the fluctuations of the ionization fraction. So the CMB photon gets screened out of the line of sight by a factor that is exponential minus tau, in a spatially dependent way, or become polarized, you know, via Thomson scattering of the CMB into the line of sight around electrons that see a non-zero local remote intensity quadrupole. They're also subject to the KSC effect, as I just described before. And I will not go into details for time constraints, but these effects actually be used to reconstruct the fluctuations of tau, just in the case of velocity reconstruction. And the spectrum of tau fluctuations during this time ends up being few orders of magnitude lower than in the case of hydrogen reionization. But note that they're quite dependent on the details of reionization, such as the typical size of, you know, reionization bubbles, as I show here. For example, in this case, these solid curves assume the same bubble model for hydrogen and helium reionization with 5 megaparsec mean bubble size. But the dash curves assume a larger typical bubble size might be more physical for helium reionization, since it's sourced by a lower number of quasars, you know, rather than an abundance of stars. And the noise, you know, likely is significantly larger than the underlying tau signal. My preliminary forecast suggests that if the tau field can be measured by an external galaxy survey, such as Rubin LSST at redshifts around 3, the reconstructed tau spectrum from CMB could in principle be detected with high precision in the near future. Just for the expert, this analysis assumes the tau field can be measured, you know, with galaxies up to tau matter cross correlations and up to the shot noise of the galaxy survey. So it might be a bit optimistic, but I know, and I also take the anticipated E, B, and temperature fields and their cross correlation in constructing various estimators, and also did a binning and redshift as the Dworkin and Smith paper from 2008. So this is interesting, I think, you know, meaning that this program of detecting helium reionization with the joint analysis of CMB and large scale structure, you know, can be pursued with multiple different methods in the near future. And in fact, another method that we're looking into is the Smith and Ferraro method that uses statistical variations of the KSC power, which leads to a similar SNR, depending on how well one can template the velocity fields in that case. But I will omit discussing that further for time constraints. But if you have, I have some slides on it if you're interested as well. Okay, great. Any questions so far? I actually don't have too much time, I just noticed. Okay, great. So far I've discussed, you know, focused on the KSC effect with a brief description, exception just now when discussing the tau reconstruction during patchy helium ionization. But in the last years, I've also worked on identifying various novel CMB signatures, including, you know, the moving lens effect, the polarized SC, and the kinetic polarized SC effects. And my efforts on these lines, you know, explore the detection prospects as well as the prospects of probing fundamental physics with these signatures. And I will briefly mention some of those findings before going into some more detail about the detection pipelines. For example, the polarized CMB-Zaldoch effect is a linear black body polarization sourced by photons that scatter off free electrons and is proportional to the removed CMB temperature quadrupole observed in electrons rest frame. Sorry, the measurement of the...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So these dates that you're listing, 2026, which is like a 3 years from now, this is for Simon's Observatory?
No, this is the first year LSST data release. Fingers crossed, I think.
Okay, so and then what CMB do you use for this?
For these, I think I've been imagining using Simon's Observatory.
But, okay, and is Simon's data also available in 2026?
Yeah, it might be a bit optimistic, but I imagine it might be.
I see. But so there's LSST and Simon's. Okay, thanks.
Right. Okay, so as I was saying, the measurement of the PSC effect allows reconstructing, you know, remove CMB quadrupole as a function of redshift on the light cone, you know, just as in the case of KSC tomography. And this allows, you know, probing some fundamental physics, like tensor to scalar ratio, for example. It's a precision that's like significantly worse than was anticipated by the low LBP measurements, of course, but nevertheless, at a precision that can test observations if R values end up being detected, you know, at around 10 to the minus 2 or so in the future. And you can read more about like the details of this analysis in this white paper that I contributed to. But polarized SC also allows, you know, probing cosmic birefringence, you know, that is sourced if the physics behind dark energy or dark matter violates the parity symmetry of the standard cosmological paradigm. And probing birefringence with PSC tomography, in my opinion, is an interesting direction because it allows reconstructing the birefringence rotation as a function of redshift. As we've shown in this paper linked here, it can contribute to ruling out a part of the parameter space where axion behaves like dark energy, where the birefringence is sourced at lower redshifts. Going further, you know, the relativistic corrections to the remote quadrupole also give rise to this time a non-black body polarization, anisotropy, shown here in this lower end of this busy plot with various other contributions to the CMB polarization. And while the signal is low because it has a unique frequency dependence and that it depends on the square of the bulk transverse velocities, which can in principle templated by galaxy surveys, it can be detected in the near future as we've shown in this paper. In this paper, we also showed that this kinetic polarized SC effect is a probe of cosmic birefringence and also in an interesting way, primordial non-Gaussianity. So I'd be interested in chatting with those who might be interested in learning more about such efforts on detecting and using the polarized SC effect for cosmology. All right. And I also worked extensively on the moving lens effect, you know, which is due to cosmological structure moving transfers to our line of sight and results of purely gravitational effects. And you can understand this effect, you know, by imagining a gravitational potential, you know, such as dark matter halo that is moving transverse to the line of sight, and the CMB photon that gets deflected into the line of sight sees an evolving potential and is subject to the ISW effect, you know, which has the form of the time integral of the time evolution of the potential. And the simple realization is that this time evolution can be written as velocity dotted with the gradient of the potential, such that the change in the CMB temperature traces directly the transverse velocity of the halo. And it forms a dipolar pattern, you know, centered at the halo center. And here's a zoomed out picture actually from a simulation. Now, the next few years, oh, any questions so far? I just have a few more minutes to finish up. Okay, in the next few years, you know, we will see pioneering first detections of these novel CMB signatures. Well, you know, which I identified so far and contributed to developing in the past years. And if anything, I'm really invested at this point to contributing to these first detections as well. You know, first detections of these signals, they're kind of impactful in multitude of ways, and they can provide robust tests of our basic understanding of cosmology and our data. So they're interesting. So I want to finish by saying a few words about the moving lens detection pipeline that I've been building for its first detection. But note that, you know, I've been leading various different detection projects, you know, pipeline building projects, including KSC tomography pipelines that I've already discussed, which can in principle be applied to a multitude of CMB secondaries in their first detection as well. And the most, but the most evolved of these that I haven't mentioned so far is an oriented stacking algorithm I've written, which will, and I will make public very soon with an accompanying paper. So this is a code that very effectively takes patches of the CMB around halos or galaxies, identified in a catalog, and orients them along the bulk transverse velocity seen by the halo, and then maps them onto a grid normalized by the estimated scale radius of the halo. So this code will be accompanied by a simple velocity reconstruction code, which I've written, that can use the galaxy or the halo catalog to reconstruct an estimate of the underlying velocity field using, you know, continuity relation, which is expected to hold on large scales where fluctuations are linear. Note that there's, of course, tested other public examples of velocity reconstruction out there that we can use. And here is a simple demonstration of how the profiles evolve as more CMB patches are stacked together. You know, these codes I mentioned, they will also accompany an analysis paper that will very robustly investigate how correlated non-Gaussian CMB foregrounds such as CIB, KSC, and TSC effects, as well as cluster lensing, which I've now coded as a part of extension to the AstroPaint code that you might know of, and radio point sources, which I don't show here. How all of these things affect the detection prospects of the moving lens effect and other CMB secondaries and follow-ups. Note that these maps and the corresponding halo catalog that I show here are from the WebSci simulation. Now you can see that this dipolar shape becomes apparent by looking at the moving lens signal only. And I find actually no apparent bias from other CMB foregrounds or the primary lens CMB in this analysis. The color bars here, you know, in this animation change at each frame. But if I was to fix them, you can see that the moving lens becomes more apparent while other contributions get reduced. But this reduction needs to be many orders of magnitude larger, you know, in order the moving lens to be seen from these stacks. So one needs, you know, much larger numbers of halos in order to make the detection. I'll show a sample of corresponding to a Rubin LSST-like galaxy survey and a CMBS4-like CMB survey in a moment. But yeah, here's another. Here's another animation showing stack profiles for a variety of halo masses and redshift for no apparent reason that except that I just wanted to put it in. Okay, so here is the total stacks using, again, an LSST Rubin-like galaxy survey and CMBS4-like experiment. And here I assume the standard photo Z errors on the galaxy redshifts, you know, both when stacking, but also when the estimating the transverse velocity from the galaxy from the halo positions, you know, which is used to rotate these patches. I also assume the 40% error on the halo masses when projecting onto the normalized grids. Nevertheless, you can see a dipolar pattern emerges in multitude of these mass redshift bins, and the total stack looks like this. You know, you can see a dipolar shape. And if I was to perform a jackknife calculation of the variance of the statistic that measures a net dipolar pattern in this patch, it suggests the detection significance of around 10 to 15 sigma from CMBS4 and Rubin LSST, which is similar to the results of my previous works. So that's cool that actually this works for oriented stacking as well. You know, finally, just to conclude, you know, this line of study is quite useful to understand how the foregrounds influence the contribution to the detection SNR of the moving lens effect, for example. You know, in the absence of these non-Gaussian foregrounds, I find smaller mass halos source the bulk of the SNR, you know, due to their large number counts. But it appears correctly taking into account all these foregrounds, the SNR gets driven to larger mass halos and lower ratios. And I believe such analysis could be useful for detecting the data analysis in the near future, or for making sense of the results when we get them, you know, say with Simons Observatory or other ongoing or upcoming experiments. So these results will be published very soon, along with a comparison paper between that compares the pairwise velocity estimation method with the oriented stacking, with the intention of getting ready for Simons Observatory data. Note that I'm also working on extensions of the study already, including one repeating this analysis for evaluating the prospects of detecting rotational KSC effect. And I can discuss more about that if anybody is interested. Okay, great. I think I'm out of time, so let me flash my conclusions. So I believe that the kinetic signal Zaldoge effect will contribute to transforming our knowledge of the fundamental properties of the universe by measuring ultra-large scales very accurately, and being able to use it with galaxy surveys as well. But you know, the benefit of KSC will definitely go beyond fundamental physics and will allow us to probe and understand better astrophysics as well. And I think a good example for that is using the joint analysis of CMB and large-scale structure into probing helium reionization, the epoch of helium reionization. And I flash here a response from an anonymous PRL referee saying, you know, maybe this is an exciting direction forward and it might reignite interest in the helium reionization. And finally, you know, next year is we'll see, you know, pioneering first detections of novel CMB signatures. And the detection pipelines for these effects are being built now. And I'm trying to build a bunch of them as well. All right, let me finish here. And thanks for your time.
Okay, great. Thanks, Salim.